Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. We start this week with a new reflection. We're going back to what we did in the first week of the 2025 year for the show. We're going back to strange laws from around the world. Did you know that it is illegal to build a sandcastle in Italy, Germany, and Spain? Mostly Spain, but in some other European countries as well. And the rationale behind this is that they do not want to have obstacles that could potentially obstruct rescue or medical teams as they attempt to rescue individuals that might be trapped or that might need their assistance. That being said, if you happen to be found to be building these illegal structures, and it's not just limited to sand castles, any form of sand sculpture, then you could very well find yourself on the receiving end of a fine of up to $300. So certainly some interesting things to be aware of there if you find yourself traveling through Europe. But you tuned into the SFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Muyaha, and on the show today, we take a look at the latest criticism that's come through from the members of parliament and from other various stakeholders around the proposed BEE fund, or the transformation fund that is to be established, or that's been proposed by the likes of the government and the Department of Trade, Industry and International Cooperation in particular. It's a 100 billion rand fund aimed at financing or assisting black businesses in growing their businesses. The fund has yet to be finalized, but it is something that was proposed last year and has already drawn criticism from various stakeholders. We're going to look into that, and we're going to look at some of the merits behind that. We're also going to have a conversation with the CEO of Business Unity South Africa, Kaz Kuvadia, around the World Economic Forum 2025 gathering that kicked off in Davos today. It's running for this entire week. We're going to look at what South Africa hopes to achieve by sending 8 of our ministers to Davos and what it is that's on the cards for us there. Then we've also got a conversation with a tech journalist around the TikTok troubles that we've been seeing in the US. We're going to look into a new tech feature that we're going to have on the show on a more regular basis. Today is the starting day of that particular feature, and we're going to look at some relevant tech news there. Then we're going to wrap things up with sticking to some of the tech-related developments, or sticking to the TikTok-related developments. We're going to look at the financial side of TikTok in the form of what they call FinTok. We're going to speak to a financial advisor around and financial planner around what to do when getting financial advice from those sorts of platforms. I have a very interesting take on that because I am involved in that space, and we'll get into that in the show. But that's what's coming up on the show today.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
As usual, we kick off the show with how the markets have been moving throughout the day. Markets have been eagerly anticipating the inauguration of President Donald J. Trump. And I'm joined on the line by Gary Boyson, Director and Portfolio Manager at Rand Swiss, to take a look at some of the other market movements throughout the day, as well as what else could be driving sentiment. Good evening, Gary. Lovely to catch up with you as always. It's been a quiet start to the week relative to how the week closed. We closed out quite bullish last week, and you kind of thought that momentum would continue, but markets clearly showing a bit of hesitation around the inauguration. It is an inevitable inauguration, but I suppose markets might be worried around those 100-plus executive orders that we could see being signed in a couple of hours.
Absolutely. I think we're ushering in the age of uncertainty. So not too much movement in the overall index. All share index was up 0.04, so we can call that flat. The resources had a fairly good day, up about 0.25%. The industrials, also a strong day. I think a little bit of optimism around a phone call between Xi Jinping and the U.S. Maybe some of those tensions between the U.S. and China just settling down a little bit. So we had the likes of Naspers and Prosus up significantly. They kind of dragged the whole index up. So that finished 0.42% up. Financials having a slightly more difficult time. That was down just over 0.5%. And I think maybe also the expectation that interest rates are going to be a little bit higher. Another thing that we need to consider is that the US is also closed this evening. So the S&P 500, NASDAQ not trading this evening because of Martin Luther King Jr. Day. It is a public holiday. It's actually got nothing to do with the Trump inauguration. It's just a coincidence that they fall on the same day. I think you might be right around the fears around what's going to happen with these executive orders, because we have seen the dollar index start to weaken from that 110 level down to 108.2. So we've seen the dollar starting to weaken against almost everything else. We've also seen the oil price start to slip. This morning we came in, it was above $80 a barrel. We've just traded down 1.5%, now trading below 80. So maybe everyone waiting to see if these executive orders are as sweeping and as dramatic as was promised on the campaign trail.
Well, Donald Trump currently holds the record, or the second place, for the most number of executive orders by any U.S. president, succeeded only by Jimmy Carter at 320 executive orders. Donald Trump comes in a close second at 220 odd executive orders. And if he plans to sign in 100 in his first kind of couple of hours of his new term of office, then we could be in for, as you said, the age of uncertainty.
Absolutely. So Biden also wasn't shy of signing the executive order. So as of the 20th of December, he had signed 160 executive orders. And I think a lot of the executive orders that Trump will sign will also reverse the moves that Biden has made. And I think he really wants to stamp his authority on the new administration. So we don't really know what the executive orders are going to be. And of course, these can still be blocked by Congress. They can be blocked by, or at least challenged by Congress, challenged in the court system as well. So we'll see what happens, but it does seem like it's going to definitely focus around the Mexican border, potential of declaring a national emergency there, potentially huge deportations as well, also sanctions on Iran, all sorts of different things. A lot of promises to live up to from the Trump administration. A lot of promises were made on the campaign trail, and I think they're already breaking them, because I think they also said before he's inaugurated there would be an end to the Russia-Ukraine conflict while he was president-elect. So I think a lot of change coming, and a lot of change when there is a complex system like the global economy. It's not always a good thing, because these kind of executive orders can have sweeping ramifications that are very, very unpredictable. But we buckle in and we see what comes in the next couple of days.
Certainly going to be an interesting day, or interesting couple of days of movements. But some of those movements that took place today that surprised markets, I don't think they really surprised markets. It was inevitable with the inauguration day drawing closer and closer, and the relationship that we've seen Donald Trump have with the cryptocurrency world. Bitcoin hit 2 million rand a coin today. I know that for the longest time, people have been saying this is nothing. We still have CEOs like Jamie Dimon calling this a scam. There's always two sides to every coin, and I suppose in this case depends on how much that coin is worth.
Absolutely, two sides to every Bitcoin. So looking at it, Donald Trump has made a huge reversal in his crypto policy on the campaign trail, promising to make the U.S. the crypto capital of the world. And I mean, I don't know, we look back to, if you remember, El Salvador adopted, I think it was Bitcoin and their own unit as legal tender. And it's had interesting effects. And I think it's still almost too soon to tell. So clearly we see a lot of the global institutions really flagging this as a terrible idea for El Salvador. You know, the IMF saying that if they continue to use Bitcoin, they're not going to basically be given loans. A lot of pressure coming from the ratings agencies as well. And even after the initial adoption, a lot of El Salvadorian people say they'd much rather be using the dollar. But again, it's one of those big uncertain events. You can kind of understand where the run in crypto has come from, though. A lot of it is the idea that there's going to be deregulation around it. A lot of the formal mechanisms within the financial system, in South Africa included, have started to adopt regulatory frameworks around cryptocurrencies, which has allowed for the launch of all sorts of crypto ETFs, informal markets on formal exchanges with real protection for investors. And what you've seen is a lot of the early adopters of crypto have have almost sold out to, or, and we don't know if they're selling out because it's very, very anonymous, but they might also be converting their holdings into more formal markets. But what we have seen is a massive inflow into these ETFs, into these regulated products around crypto, and the demand is very, very high. So, yeah, crypto running at the moment, but again, I don't know how to value this. You know, everyone tells me that it's about scarcity. There's only so many coins that can ever be mined. But, you know, if you can keep duplicating coins, I believe Donald Trump and Melania Trump have now launched their own coins ahead of the inauguration as well. If you can keep on duplicating it, what kind of scarcity is there? And of course, how do you value it? I mean, some people say fundamentally you can value it on the electricity consumption, and that can kind of give you an underpin. But you know, it's not a, you know, other than being a potentially a store of value and a medium of exchange, like it doesn't create anything, and that's always going to be a concern. So our view is, you know, it's an interesting asset class. It's very dynamic. It's very exciting if the world was to move towards decentralized currency, but buyer beware, be very, very careful.
The Trump coin, I forgot that we even had that. It's going to be interesting to see how that shapes up. Speaking of valuations and how you value things, I want to look at this before you go, Gary. This happened a while ago. It happened late last year, but it's kind of gone fairly unnoticed and fairly under the radar. The post office issued new stamps in November of last year, and the stamp that was issued on November 16 of last year bears the face of the President of the Republic, President Cyril Ramaphosa. Valuations. At some point, stamps used to be a rarity, and in some countries, you can still collect stamps. Is that the case in South Africa?
No, I'm sure. I'm not a stamp collector, but for us, it falls squarely in the alternative asset class. And a lot of the alternative asset classes, they do generate their value through scarcity, because the reason that a stamp collection or a coin collection or a piece of art is very different from a bond or a share is that a bond will pay you a coupon. And, you know, you're lending a company money or you're lending a government money, and they're promising to give you more money when they repay you. So the same with a share, you're taking a stake in a company. The company is going to produce things. When they sell it and make a profit, you're going to have a claim on those profits via dividends or share buybacks. And that's where the value comes from, those two asset classes, which are the major asset classes. If you look at the alternatives, a lot of this comes to scarcity. So, you know, the very rare stamps are obviously worth a lot of money because you can't replicate that specific run. You know, if a stamp has an error in it, for example, and there was only one run of it, there's that scarcity. But remember that anything only has value because someone else will buy it from you. And if stamps fall out of favor and no one's collecting stamps anymore because we're not using the post office and we're all on email and stamps become something of the past, that stamp collection is not going to have the kind of longevity that you might expect.
Very interesting take on alternative assets. Just out of interest, there are 750,000 stamps that were printed that bear the face of President Cyril Ramaphosa there. So I don't know how scarce that makes that. But we're going to have to leave the conversation there. Gary, thanks so much, as always, for the time and for the insights. Gary Boyson, Director and Portfolio Manager at Rand Swiss, joining us to take a look at some of the market movements throughout the day, as well as what's potentially been driving those.
Money rules. Money.
With interest rates dropping, is it time to refinance your mortgage? In this week's episode of the Money Rules podcast with me, Boitumelo Ntsoko, I chat with Dawn Riddler of Rexilum Invest about the benefits, risks, and different refinancing options available and how to secure the best deal. To listen to this and more Money Rules episodes, go to moneyweb.co.za or the MoneyWeb app.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Now, something else that happened last week was the announcement that the government was potentially looking to establish a new type of transformation fund, a 100 billion rand transformation fund. And now the Minister of Trade, Industry and Competition, Park Stau, has come back around that particular fund, saying that in response to some questions that were asked in Parliament, how that fund would be financed, what would be the objectives of the fund, and just responding to some of the questions around that. I'm joined on the line by the founder for the Center for Economic Development and a Transformation, Duma Qobule, to take a look at this and see if we can understand it and get our heads around it. Good evening, Duma. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start with a bit of a backstory around this proposed fund. 100 billion rand fund to be carved out of effectively existing businesses for the purposes of supporting black businesses. When this was initially proposed, we kind of didn't have a very clear idea around where we were going with the fund. What were the initial conversations around it?
Okay, let me explain how it works. Okay, so there is no new tax. This so-called new tax has been in the law since 2013. So the amended B codes of 2013, so many companies, large companies especially, are implementing this as we speak. So there's a B scorecard, and there is an element of the scorecard called enterprise and supply development. So the reason why, so you've got different monetary and non-monetary contributions that companies can make. I'll just give you an example of them. So you could give grants to small companies, then you can also calculate the overhead costs that you incur in supporting these enterprises. You could provide loans, interest-free loans. You could provide guarantees for them. You could provide lower interest rates. You could have equity investments in these companies. I used to work for Telkom. You could calculate the contributions in the form of human resource capacity, where you second people towards working in these small enterprises or organizations that represent these small enterprises. But the reason I'm going through these things is that a simplistic way of looking at it, you'd need to calculate what. So the target is 3% of net profit after tax. But the problem is when you try to translate it into a monetary value, because most of the contributions are not monetary values. And the companies that I've worked for in the past, I would even say the majority would not necessarily be monetary contributions. It would be non-monetary contributions. That's number one. Number two is that if you want to calculate the value of this fund, there's a simplistic way into it. So you go to the top 100 companies, and then you calculate their NPAT, and then you net profit after tax, and then you say 3%. And then some people, a friend of mine, she did this some years ago. She says she came to 50 billion rands when she did this. But it's a moving target every year. Now, the problem I have with those type of calculations, the BEE Commission also came with its own calculation. They said there's potentially 26 billion rands that has already happened. So the problem I have with those calculations is that many of these contributions are non-monetary. So you can't convert them into a fund that we're going to lend to black business. So I would have wanted them to do actual research and go and talk to the top companies, Anglo-American, all top companies, say, what are your current enterprise development contributions? What have you done? So I think it's a flawed assumption to come up with a monetary value because you don't know what is there. That's number one. And then, so even the 26 billion that they come to, we don't even know if it's if it's a monetary value or it's hard money in the company. And then the last thing I want to say is that the other problem with coming up with a monetary value when you don't, in fact, so basically the minister didn't know what he's talking about the 100 billion rand. They don't know where they get it because they haven't done the research as to how much enterprise development. Now, the third thing is that there are companies, Jimmy, that said, this is a headache. We don't want to do it. So we're going to give it to third parties to do it on our behalf. So you have all these supplier development initiatives by individual companies that say, we will manage it for you. So I do remember that Telkom did it and they gave it to a third party to manage. But the problem is, I doubt that it adds up to anything close to 100 billion rand because I don't think a lot of companies do it. And then the last thing I want to say is that many years ago, probably 10 years ago, the National Empowerment Fund, who has been tasked with doing this, the previous CEO had a plan that we're not getting government funding. We're going to go out to the market and we're going to try and become the third party provider of this, you know, and we're going to collect whatever it is. But to my, they weren't successful in doing it. And I don't see why they will be successful this time. I will be speaking to them soon, yeah.
Duma, I want to look at some...
I just think that in South Africa, we mustn't talk about things that you don't know. You know, I follow the stuff that you can't go out there and say 100 billion rands when you don't know how much is out there. Do you see what I'm saying?
Duma, and I want to look at the calculations. I mean, one of the things, I mean, entities are expected to contribute the 3% of net profit after tax. If we look at it from that perspective, how do you then also practically enforce that? Companies are not going to have the same year of financial performance every single year, right? So you're realistically going to have a year that performs better, a year that performs worse, but you're also going to have companies that might defer profits or that might incur significant losses so that your net profit is seemingly lower. So this is also now creating a new conundrum around the valuation of this fund if we are to do
purely
as a tax.
Well, it's not a tax because it's been there for 12 years, you know, most of it's not a tax, really. They're definitely not a tax. So, but the point is, some companies do make monetary contributions, but I wouldn't say, I don't know, but my gut feel tells me that the majority of them don't make actual monetary contributions.
So managing that side of it is going to be quite different. Let's look at the actual transformation objectives. I mean, you've established the Center for Economic Development and Transformation. Obviously, we've been on a very clear kind of conversation as South Africa, the transformation needs to take place and that we need to be financing certain things and we need to all kind of do our part in various ways, right? And that's kind of why the BEE code exists, and that's come into question as well.
Yeah, you know, Jimmy, I think this one, okay, so now I think I was the one who first proposed something like this, but I had proposed that the government would provide a seed funding for it, and it would be, you know, from the IDC, the NEF, and, you know, all the government agency would be providing some kind, so it would be the government would seed it, you know, but now they've gone the different way, and they're saying that this is, it's private sector initiatives, but you can't put a number for it. To do the research on it, it's going to take a long time. Yeah, and that's why nobody has done the research. You know, I can tell you right now what is a black ownership on the stock exchange. That's an easy calculation. I can tell you what's the black board members. I can tell you what's the black management. But ESG is very tricky to measure because companies don't even disclose it in their annual reports. So it's almost impossible to find out what is the universe out there. Yeah.
Duma, do you think this becomes even more complicated to administer or to put in place now that we've got a government of national unity? I mean, the likes of the DA have already noted their criticism towards what has been mentioned by the minister. They're supposed to all be working together as part of one united front, and you're already seeing different views on this. Do you think this is something that makes it even harder to implement?
Okay, so that's a very good question, Jimmy. So now we've been past the Bella. Now there's National Health Service, National Health Insurance. This one is a bubbling under, you know, kind of, you know, what can I call it? Potential area of, you know, conflict between the parties in the GNU. So I do think that, I think they need to come together as well at the level of the GNU and discuss not just this one, the Transformation Fund, what is their position on the whole transformation policy? Because we have a policy in the BEE codes. Does the DA and the other seven parties agree with this thing, or do we have to redo it, you know? And I think this is a discussion that is actually has to be done at the GNU. I do think, Jimmy, that there will be compromises on... I think this is not going to be as difficult as people think it's going to be, because... This BEE codes, I think it's accepted by most of the large companies. You know, you can see people moaning on social media, but most of the companies, if you open just a random annual report, companies will report on this as part of ESG. And so I don't think it's something out of the ordinary for most of the large companies, but many of the smaller companies might be complaining, but there are exemptions for the smaller companies in terms of BEE. But I do think it's a discussion that we have to have at the level of the Government of National Unity.
Lots to consider, lots to still have conversations about. We can't just implement things without thinking them through. That's been our shortfall in the past. We'll leave the conversation there. Duma, thanks so much for the time and for the insights. That's Duma Qobule, who is the founder for the Center for Economic Development and Transformation, joining me to take a look at the latest conversation that's been happening around this BEE Transformation Fund.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's just gone 6:30. If you're tuning in, you're listening to the SFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Moyaha, and we're chatting to the CEO of Business Unity South Africa, Kaz Kuvadia, around the World Economic Forum gathering that's kicked off in Davos this week. He joins me now on the line to take a look at some of the objectives of South Africa, as well as what we can make of this year's gathering. Good evening, Uncle Kaz. Lovely to catch up with you as always. We'll get into a couple of the conversations around the B20 and the G20 and all of those things. But the World Economic Forum kicking off this week, everybody has their own agendas. Everybody has their own objectives to achieve. South Africa has taken about 8 or so ministers to the World Economic Forum gathering. What is South Africa's objective at this year's gathering?
Hi, and always good to talk to you, Angela. Just to quickly say that I'm no longer CEO at BUSA. I did retire. Kulekane has taken over. And I'm at the World Economic Forum, essentially, on B20 work. But having said that, I was at the pre-Davos briefing that the Minister of Finance pulled together on Thursday. And essentially, I think South Africa is coming into the World Economic Forum within a context of much more positivism than we've had before. I think that there is the government-business partnership is beginning to show results. I think the government of national unity, a new administration is beginning to show results, and it seems to be holding. And certainly at the pre-Davos briefing, business and government were very much at idem that we are at an inflection point and we should present, because we do have a united sort of partnership in the country, and we should present that at Davos, and we should look at issues related to digital economy, we should look at issues related to geopolitical problems that are around, but we better positioned right now to promote the country, to promote investment, and to demonstrate that we have an administration that's gelling well together and actually making a difference.
Thank you very much, Uncle Kaz, for that correction. I forgot that Mr. Mate took over at the start of January this year. Yes, we've kicked off the year, and that was, of course, that announcement that the CEO change would happen in January of 2025. But on the matter of the World Economic Forum, we have taken quite a steep delegation, or quite a large delegation, to the World Economic Forum. Is there something that we need to be aware of there? Why such a big delegation this time around?
Well, I think there's a big delegation because the country appears to be in a better position than it was in the last few years. I think that in the last few years we had serious problems on the energy side with load shedding and so on, serious problems on the logistics side. We made good progress on energy as a result of the business government partnership. We're beginning to make progress on the logistics side. I think that South Africa has demonstrated through the last elections that we are a mature democracy that can actually manage well a change in leadership. I think the ANC conducted itself admirably after the elections in accepting the election, in starting the discussions toward the government of national unity. And we formed in 2 or 3 weeks what it takes some countries in Europe 1.5 years to form, a government of national unity that works. So I think that one, because it's a government of national unity, there are a number of parties involved, so the delegation is bigger, but the business delegation is bigger, more senior, because we have confidence that we are working together and we are actually making a difference.
Mm. Uncle Kaz, what else is on the agenda for the World Economic Forum gathering? I know that the climate conversation is not going away just yet, but what else is expected to be discussed this week?
And the climate one, obviously, I think the geopolitical issues. I mean, Trump is being inaugurated today, a significant development geopolitically. I think there are a number of geopolitical hotspots. I think that have got to be looked at, even though this is a business sort of WEF is all about business, but the geopolitics is beginning to affect business, and business needs to look at that. I think issues related to finance and raising of finance and financing of not from the point of view of just financing of developments in the countries in the south that are on the basis of investment in those countries, and I think investment and infrastructure is a critical issue at WEF, and then the digital economy. I think that that's essentially the theme of WEF this year. The AI digitalization, what that means, what the advantages are, what the pitfalls are, and how countries like South Africa actually manage those so that it enables us to continue to grow our economy and not stifle the little growth that we've got. So I think those are some of the issues that are on the agenda that will be discussed. And I think that the fact that we have, it's no longer a unipolar world. We do have BRICS, and BRICS has grown and is becoming a factor in both in geopolitics, but also, intra-BRICS trade is significant currently. And so I think that the fact that the world is changing geographically, the world is changing in the sense that it's no longer a unipolar world, the fact that some countries in the north are becoming more protectionist. All of those are issues I think that WEF needs to discuss and should be on the agenda.
Mm. From a business perspective, you and I have also spoken about BUSA's role and the particular positioning of the B20 that's coming into this year, understanding that we are the G20 presidency country of the year. And I know there's an official opening that's taking place for the B20 next month in Cape Town. I'm sure you and I will catch up there as well. Are you looking to bring some of those agenda points to the World Economic Forum stage here, understanding that the platform is there already and it could set it up quite nicely for further conversations next month?
Yeah, I mean, some of us are here specifically for that purpose. We're interacting with people like MasterCard and Bloomberg and others. We're interacting with some global businesses to promote B20 in South Africa. We are absolutely clear that we want to make this an African B20, so we'll also be interacting with Africa Collective here, which comes to Davos every year and brings a number of African business people and African CEOs, and we'll be interacting with them, essentially to promote the B20, to talk about how we want to manage it. We are the fourth country in a row, that country in the south, that will be that is hosting the B20 after Indonesia, India, Brazil, and now ourselves, and we hand over to the United States. So I think we also have a responsibility to consolidate the priorities of the South as we hand over to the United States. And we're here in Davos to actually talk to global business leaders, to talk to business organizations, to talk to multilateral organizations about the B20, what our plans are, and what sort of support we need for them, not financial support, but support in professional support and expertise and so on in the various task forces that will be run by the B20.
It's not an agenda that is light on topics of discussion, so there's much to be discussed this week. Hopefully we get some positive outcomes. We wish you and the teams the very best of luck in all of the engagements throughout the week, and we look forward to seeing the outcomes of these engagements. We'll leave the conversation there. That was Cas Kovadia of Business Unity South Africa and of the B20 joining us to take a look at what's on the agenda for the World Economic Forum gathering in Davos this week.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
As I've been saying for the last couple of weeks, it is a new year, which means we are trying new things. And part of those new things that we're going to be trying out is this next segment. We're going to be looking at introducing a little more of a tech conversation, perhaps expanding into a little more than a just technology. We might look at other things as well. We have got a couple of tech commentators that you've heard us speak to in the past, the likes of Mudiwa Kavaza that I enjoy speaking to ever so much. But there is another tech specialist and tech journalist that I've been keeping under wraps for the longest time. I think it's finally time the world meets her, all courtesy to my wonderful producer. Her name is Nafisa Akabor. She's going to be joining us for a tech feature that we're going to do on the show quite regularly. We're going to try and look at tech news, what's happening in the tech space, how we get around understanding all of these dynamics. And I thought with all of the events happening around the TikTok conversation, this would be a good time to start. So she joins me on the line now to take a look at what's been happening with the TikTok ban in the US. Is it on? Is it not? Who's paying? Who's not paying? What's happening? And everything else in between. Good evening, Nafisa. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start with the ban, right? So it was there. President Joe Biden said there'd be a ban. Then he said, no, I'm leaving office. It's not my responsibility. The next president can handle it. Then TikTok said, okay, we're going to have to shut down the servers. Then they said, we're not shutting down the servers. Now, 24 hours later, there was a ban that wasn't really a ban, but now Americans have TikTok. What happened here?
So hi, Jimmy. Thanks for having me. So actually, if we go back a little further, it was actually President Trump who initiated the TikTok ban. And now he's going to be the so-called savior to sort of unban it. It's actually so, it makes the US look quite foolish, I'm sure you admit. It was less than 24 hours of a ban.
Yeah, so my understanding around that was as well that obviously with what President Biden had signed in, that there was probably some legislative part of it from a legal standpoint that would have forced TikTok to shut down servers and all of that. So technically abiding by those conditions. But Trump came out before being inaugurated saying he was going to save TikTok and he was going to put an end to this and make sure that TikTok can continue. And now we had a whole bunch of people that used the service seemingly left in limbo for a couple of hours. At this point, he still hasn't been inaugurated, or the inauguration takes place today. But where do we stand on the TikTok business in the US? I mean, it's about north of 150 million plus users in the US, almost a little more than around half the population of the US. So where do we stand on whether or not US citizens are using the TikTok platform?
Well, they definitely use it given the outcry that we've seen. I'm a TikTok user myself. I've seen a lot of people putting these sad farewell posts saying that they lost their job in lockdown, because you might remember that it really kicked off in the pandemic. TikTok really took off then. So a lot of people started their spin-off businesses or when they lost jobs. So this obviously means a lot to a lot of creators in the US, given what a large market they are. But what I'm also curious about is when Trump said that he's going to save it, he mentioned that he'd like the US to have a 50% ownership position in a joint venture. Now, we know TikTok's stance throughout. They weren't willing to sell to a different owner, which I commend them for. So I'm just curious now. Yes, they're allowing it. They're giving them like a 90-day extension. But I wonder how this conversation is going to go, because I don't see TikTok selling to 50% to a company in the US. I'm not sure whether you've seen that, or it doesn't seem like it fits with what they've been saying all along.
Yeah, so that's the other bizarre side of it, right? Is you want them to stay on and continue offering services, but you also want it to be on your terms, and those terms might not be favorable to a company like a TikTok. From a TikTok perspective, do you think there is merit in them saying, okay, we agree to the deal? Because effectively, you're now losing half of your revenue or half of your ownership, but you are still keeping quite a big market, and you're still able to sort of still access that market. On access, I want to get into another chat as well around what Americans have been doing. But do you think for now that it's in TikTok's interests to even consider this deal?
I don't think they should sell. They have nothing to be guilty of, especially not what they're being accused of. There's no proof that the Chinese government has access to American users' data. So for that reason, I commend them. They shouldn't do it. But it will be interesting to see how it plays off, because we know the TikTok CEO, Shou Chou, is actually attending the inauguration of Trump.
And that, we know, is only attended by invitation. So that would have had to have been an invitation extended to him to attend that inauguration. I don't think it's something that is open to the public to a certain extent, depending
Agreed.
On where you are. Yeah. Nafisa, I want to look at what Americans have done in the interim. I want to look at a little known company, Xiaohongshu. That's its government name. Its more recognized street name is Red Note. Americans just decided, okay, fine, if you think that we're selling our data to the Chinese, we're going to sign up for a Chinese-based company. That was a very deliberate response, I think, from the American users to make a statement to their own government to say, we don't agree with what you're trying to enforce.
Yeah, I thought it was one of the funniest things I've seen this year. I know we're very early into 2025, but there was a term TikTok refugee being thrown around. I was actually so amused by it. These users, I actually downloaded RedNote. I just held my username and I deleted the app. But the short while I was there, I could see people saying, we don't care. We want the Chinese government can take our data. This is what Americans were saying. And they weren't even joking. They're like, we're not going to use, like, for example, Meta platforms, Meta-owned ones. That's how much they were rebelling against what was happening, that they were just willing to find a new home, so to speak.
Mm. And that's the other thing, right, was the Meta side of it. Meta came out and thought this would be a great opportunity for us to take advantage of this and to come out and offer the exact same TikTok kind of features and replicate those features. And users just came out and said, no, we're not interested. You might be a US-owned company. You might be what we knew as Facebook and stuff, but that's not what we want. We want to keep TikTok. That was a very, very interesting message as well from the users of the platform, particularly in the US, that they abandoned a US company and said we'd rather still go with a Chinese company.
I was very surprised by that. I was shocked. Like, you would think, oh, naturally, let's go back to Instagram where we all started. It already has similar videos. But sure, they had such strong opinions about it.
Mm.
And also for Instagram to release such similar features the day before the ban.
Reminds me of a time that Meta did, what did they do after the takeover of X? They released Threads and said, well, it's not Twitter. It's similar. It's the same thing. And I guess you got the same reaction as well, is now you've gone from almost being seen as a leader in the social media space to someone that's just replicating what other people are doing. Nafisa, before I let you go, I want to look at the monetization aspect of it all. I mean, a lot of the TikTok and content creators said that they derive a living from this. People are able to sell things in the TikTok shop. Others are able to generate subscriptions from their followers and all of those sorts of things. Clearly, the world of social media has transitioned from just being, we're sharing our lives, we're sharing the social things that are happening, to saying we are actually using some of these platforms to earn a living.
Yeah, and also the two you mentioned, there is another aspect of the sponsored content, obviously. I'm sure you know that's such a big deal. The creator economy is growing. We even know that print advertising is in decline. So it is a big deal, and this is how people make money. So it's, I completely understand why the users felt this way, but it shouldn't be ignored. It's just going to grow the creator economy. And platforms like TikTok is obviously going to be behind it.
What's next for that creator economy? Because understanding that from a tech perspective, things like artificial intelligence are advancing at a rapid rate. And I mean, we use them for different things. I, for one, use artificial intelligence to help with some of the video content that we create as well, outside of the radio space as well. So it's clearly something that's not going to slow down. Where do you see the kind of the next evolution of where the tech economy goes and where creators generate their livings from?
I think we're going to see more AI-generated profiles and them creating the sponsored content. So as weird as it sounds, these AI could be taking jobs from the creators. Does that make sense? Because a brand can say, hey, let's create my own AI person and let them create the message that we want and let us push it. So technically, they're not even paying an actual creator. Do you follow? It's going to be, someone you can create on one of these generative AI apps.
One of the things that you and I are going to look into, Nafisa, in one of our many sessions to come is going to be, I want to look at this whole fund setup where creators are rewarded, but some platforms don't offer creator funds or rewards in certain countries and those sorts of restrictions. But that'll have to be a conversation for another day because we have run out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been lovely having you on the show. I think this is going to be the first of many great conversations around the tech, EV and evolutionary space that we all find ourselves in the modern era. That was Nafisa Akabor, who's a tech and EV journalist, but also the founder of Recharged, joining us to take a look at our new feature that we're having on the show, our tech feature.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And sticking with the TikTok theme of the day and the things that are happening on that platform, we thought we'd take a look at the increase in the FinTok space as part of our personal finance segment. We're going to look at the upsides of that, the downsides of that, try and see if we can get our heads around it. Just a disclaimer before we start this conversation, I might have a vested interest here because I technically might be considered a FinTok influencer at some point. But I'm joined on the line by financial planner from Family Wealth Custodians, Hardi Swart, to take a look at this, see if we can get our heads around it. Good evening, Hardi. Lovely to chat to you again. Let's start with just an overview of the FinTok space. What kinds of conversations are taking place in that space, and how do we define it as kind of a FinTok conversation for those that don't know?
Jimmy, yeah, no, the FinTok space is actually quite broad, you know, everything from crypto assets to putting your cash under your pillow. So it's a very broad category. So very difficult to define, you know. Some of the stuff in my comprehensive market research I did, meaning I just watched a couple of TikTok videos, very interesting. I mean, a couple of things that I thought had a good laugh, very good tips. And then there's a couple of things where I thought to myself, as a financial planner, if I gave that sort of advice, I'd probably end up in jail. You know, absolutely ridiculous stuff that I saw. So, yeah, it's very broad and quite difficult to define. But in principle, it's when you get some sort of financial advice from a TikTok video, but not necessarily from someone that's qualified to give advice. Could be anyone.
Now, Hardi, when we look at this FinTok space, I mean, there's a difference between financial advice and financial commentary in terms of opinions and financial information. How do we see some of the trends that are shaping up in the FinTok space at the moment?
Yeah, Jimmy, so I think the difficult thing, I mean, you know, as a financial advisor, you know, what you say, you can be held accountable for, you know, by the FSCA as a fiduciary and giving advice. Where often some of these comments that the guys make, you know, there's no sort of greater governing body or someone that they have to sort of underlying, you know, what they that oversees what they say. So that's a bit of a risk, I'd say. But there's definitely a trend, increase in demand for these videos. And I think some of it is also for entertainment value, not only just for the advice that you get.
Hardi, I want to look at some of the dangers of these these conversations and these posts that are being put up from a TikTok perspective. Now, as I mentioned at the start of the conversation, there was a bit of a disclaimer there. I personally do a couple of conversations on here. I've got a podcast that I host with a good friend of mine, Simon Brown. And on our podcast, I don't know about other podcasts, but we have a very clear disclaimer that says the conversations we have are not financial advice. You should speak to a financial advisor. We are sharing our opinions on certain matters. What are some of the dangers and downsides towards looking to platforms like TikTok for financial advice when you don't know who you can trust, who's giving you verified information, and generally who has your best interests at heart?
Yeah, no, Jimmy, it's a tough one, I must say. I mean, I wasn't part of a conversation over the weekend where two guys were talking about, I mean, guys that one is a farmer and the other one, I don't know what he does. I think he's a mechanic. They were talking about FinTok and how they got this tip on meme coins and they invest into meme coins. And they literally, the one guy said he made more money in a week than he made out of his investment in the S&P in 10 years. And then I was like, yes, but is that, did you really make the money or was it just a gamble? You know, because you could basically go to the casino and put your money on red or black. Probably the same thing, because there's no underlying asset, there's no value. So how do you know, you know, this, I don't see this as, there's no way you can say that's an investment. So I think it's a difficult one to answer. You know, and the other thing is, there's a big trend also with AI pushing some of this stuff. So is the thing that you're seeing on TikTok, is it even a real person or is it some AI generated content? You know, and like I said earlier, as a financial advisor, there's some sort of accountability for the advice we give. And like you said, I also have an online podcast, and have a disclaimer beforehand to say, listen, this is not supposed to be personal financial advice. It's just general, you know, where often many times the things that I see these people are actually giving advice saying, invest, yeah, don't miss this opportunity once in a lifetime. And I, no. not a great place to be.
Mm. The other side of it as well is when you're on a platform like social media platforms, and we've seen this as well from our podcast perspective, from the people that are within our networks, where you get people, and I've had this conversation with the FSCA as well, where you get people that impersonate other individuals. So I know Hardy, I know Jimmy, I go and I create via AI a profile that impersonates these people, and I use the impersonating profile to go and do nefarious things and take monies from other individuals. If we are to give people warnings out there or red flags to look out for, obviously the main one, and this is one that we've driven home with the FSCA on the show before, is if something is too good to be true, more than likely is too good to be true. Take it as it is, there it is, right? But what are some of the other things as a financial advisor that you've seen in the industry that you can easily say to someone, if someone is promising you this, it simply isn't possible?
Sure, yeah, Jimmy. I mean, we see it so many times. And the sad thing is, I think so many people are desperate for better returns for different reasons, and they fall for these scams. And the sad thing, the other day I had a client who, well, not a client of mine, but a client's friend that had a situation where her social media account was hacked. And then the person who hacked her social media account sent this, posted things about how she made all this millions in this investment, big Ponzi scheme. And some of her friends actually looked at it. And there was one specific lady that invested into the scheme because she thought it was a legitimate source. And then afterwards only found out that her social media account was hacked and was an absolute scam. You know, so I think it's so difficult to sort of discern what is real and what's not real. So I think from an investor point of view, exactly what you said, if something sounds too good to be true, you know, you're not going to double your money overnight, or you know, to make from R1,000 make it R1,000,000 in a week. It's absolutely that sort of thing doesn't happen. So I think, I mean, if you are sort of on the fence, consult a professional. You know, you can go onto the Financial Planning Institute's website. They've got a list of qualified financial advisors. Consult one of these guys and get a professional opinion. Is this thing real or is it a scam?
So it is very easy to just have those conversations, and that's kind of why these institutions, and as you said, why financial planners and financial consultants exist, is so that you can have those conversations with them. Hardy, before I let you go, I want to look at some of the positives that we've seen from these platforms. It's always good to see some really good conversations happening. I mean, that's kind of, again, from a biased perspective, it was one of the reasons we started the podcast that we started. I'm sure it's the reason you started your podcast, was there is some information out there that is valuable information. Someone is wanting to provide you with good insights and credible insights, and it's for you as a user and as a content consumer to exercise a bit of judgment to say, this person might not know who I am, but they're not trying to pull the wool over my eyes.
Agreed, Jimmy, 100%. I mean, like I said, I watched some of those videos, and some of the stuff that I saw was actually good advice, you know, stuff like budgeting, like just planning for future events, like investing in low-cost funds. There's a lot of things that I thought to myself, wow, this is actually not bad advice. So I agree 100%. I think, you know, if you do watch these things, which is good in many circumstances, just make sure that the content you are listening to comes from a legitimate source. Now, so oftentimes, like on YouTube or on podcasts, you can actually go to the company's website and do a bit of research and make sure that if you are listening to someone, that they're actually credible and that the things that are saying is legitimate. So I think, but yeah, I agree. There are good content out there, but just discern what you're listening to and make sure you do your research.
Discernment is absolutely imperative. Do your research, speak to financial advisors, speak to financial planners. That's why they exist. But it is not the worst thing to get some good, decent advice from social media. I suppose we're all consuming information in different ways, and this might be a very convenient way for you to consume some information, especially if you've had questions around certain things. We'll leave the conversation there. Hardy, thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Hardy Swart, financial planner at Family Wealth Custodians.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Just like that, we've come to the end of our show. Thanks, folks, for tuning in to the show. If you've missed any of our conversations, they are available as podcasts. You know exactly where to find them. If you're not following any of our socials by now, shame on you. You should be, because we give all of our information up on those platforms. It is coming up to 7 o'clock. Greg Hose is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the top sport team. From my side, I'm going to have to say good night, but we will still be around for the rest of the week. But for now, good night.